This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
The application of knowledge discovery within the cloud is immensely powerful, but not inbuilt. As organizations continue to better understand the analytic power and economies of cloud computing in the sense of data storage, sharing, and management, they are discovering that big data is more than just a discussion of technology. It's a discussion of what can be accomplished when massive data and cloud efficiencies combine to make advanced analysis and innovation possible. Booz Allen Hamilton has developed an integrated approach to cloud computing, systems development, trust, cybersecurity, and advanced analytics and innovation, and we help government at all levels build effective online applications that protect critical assets and improve the speed and effectiveness of constituent services to deliver time and cost savings. Booz Allen is ready for what's next. Learn more at boozallen.com/expertvoices.
Booz Allen Hamilton is pleased to present a panel discussion on Big Data, the Art of Advanced Analytics, as part of its Expert Voices panel series on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Good morning. Welcome to the October 14th, 2010 event, Big Data, Advancing the Art of Analytics, part of the Booz Allen Hamilton Expert Voices Distinguished Speakers Program, sponsored by the Cloud Computing Investment and the Advanced Analytics Capability. It is my pleasure to introduce Christopher Kelly, Senior Vice President of Booz Allen Hamilton. Chris?
Welcome to Expert Voices, everybody. My name is Chris Kelly, a Senior Vice President with Booz Allen and Hamilton. Today's topic is Big Data, Advancing the Art of Analytics. I think we're going to have a really interesting conversation, and we brought together a really terrific panel. Let me take a minute to introduce them to you. First, we have Mike Byrne. Mike's the Geographic Information Officer for the Federal Communications Commission. He's the former GIO for the state of California and an expert in the design, development, implementation, and use of GIS for research and policy. He served as a chair for the California GIS Council. He's a member of the National Geospatial Advisory Committee and on the board of directors for both Green Info Networks and the National States GIS Council. We also have with us Jeff Jonas. Jeff's chief scientist, IBM Entity Analytics Group, and an IBM Distinguished Engineer. He's a member of the Markle Foundation Task Force on National Security in the Information Age, a board member of the U.S. Geospatial Intelligence Foundation. He's on the EPIC Advisory Board, a senior associate at the Center for Strategic International Studies, and a distinguished engineer for information systems as an adjunct at Singapore Management University. We also have David Mihalsik. David is the Chief Technology Officer for the Defense Information Systems Agency. As a CTO, he serves as the agency's senior authority on scientific, technical, and engineering matters. David is responsible for defining DISA's overarching technical strategy for synchronizing the agency's programs and services with the Department of Defense's net-centric transformation. Also with us is Chris Nissen. Chris is a consulting engineer in the National Security Analysis Group with the MITRE Corporation, where he is currently working to define and realize the development of massive data analytics systems for a variety of U.S. government applications. And finally, we have Mike Olson. Mike is the CEO of Cloudera, an enterprise software company which provides Apache Hadoop-based software and services. Mike was formerly CEO of SleepyCat Software, the makers of Berkeley DB, the open-source embedded database engine. Mike spent 2 years at Oracle Corporation as vice president for embedded technologies after Oracle's acquisition of SleepyCat in 2006. So I think we brought together a really good group, and I think we're just going to start off with some baselining. Today's conversation really is going to be broken into three parts. First, we're going to talk about what is big data. Then we're going to talk about how you manage it, and then finally, how you use it. So, Jeff, if you don't mind, I'd like to start with you. Maybe you can help us, from your perspective, define what we mean by big data.
Well, I think some people, when they hear the term big data, they think that means just lots of data. And while that happens to be true, big data is about lots of data. But I think more importantly, big data is about something that's different that happens when you have big data. And I got to tell you, at times it seems somewhat magical. It almost, to me, seems like a new physics at times. I'll give you three examples. When you get to big data, it starts to turn out that bad data becomes good for you. An example of this would be when you search Google, the errors that people make in their searches are actually retained and it's commingled with the other data that Google has. So when you go and search Google now, the hints that it gives you comes from everybody else's errors. I think that's interesting. If they didn't save the errors, it wouldn't be so helpful. Another example, and you see this at Google as well, is you see that more data in this big data environments, you end up finding early and weaker signal. So you've seen some stuff out of Google with flu detection that shows up before other flu sensing systems in the U.S. A third example, which is really my favorite, it's what I'm really fascinated with these days myself, is there's a phenomenon that I've seen now in big data where the more data you get, not only does your prediction get better, lower false positives, lower false negatives, but it becomes faster with more data. What I mean by that is imagine if you have 3 billion rows of data, there's a computational cost to see what a new piece of data means. Imagine when you get to 8 billion rows, suddenly the computational cost is less. It's faster with more data. That seems counterintuitive. The simple way to explain that, by the way, is it's the same phenomenon when you put a puzzle together at home. How come the last few pieces are as fast as the first few pieces? You have more puzzle pieces in front of you at the end of the puzzle than you had in the beginning, yet it's getting there's a point where it gets faster and faster, and that's a big data phenomenon. So there you go, Chris.
Thanks, Jeff. So, Mike, I was also thinking about, from your perspective, how big data requires us to not only think about data differently, but also use data differently. What's your perspective on this definition?
Well, I agree with the things that Jeff said pretty strongly. When you have a large amount of detailed data, you can see patterns that are simply invisible in smaller amounts in less data. So having a large amount of detail allows you to understand, to see trends earlier. The Google flu example is a great one. It's also true that it's not homogeneous. That is, the data that you look at now comes from many different sources. So in the example of some of the early web properties, if I'm able to collect information about user behavior on my site, what people look at, the pages they visit, how long they spend looking at a particular image, when they click on a particular link, if I can combine that behavioral information with actual transaction information, downline, what did people purchase off of an e-commerce site, for example, I can make very smart decisions. I can make much better predictions about what people are interested in. The kinds of analytics that you need to do over that various data are just different from the kinds of analytics that we did in the 80s and 90s over relatively smaller amounts of much more homogeneous tabular data. So as data scales, as the variety of sources expands, and as the velocity at which that data arrives increases, you need not just different storage infrastructure, you need to build a different processing infrastructure to think about, to digest, to extract value and profit from that data.
Great points. I'm wondering how our government agencies and private sector companies are actually learning how to consume large data. And, you know, thinking about how to bring it in, absorb it, and make it available. I know we have a lot of challenges with the data that we have today, but can you talk about that, guys?
Yeah, I'd like to touch on something Mike said. I think he's right in this notion of new ways of interacting. And I tend to think of, I think we used to think the core elements in database design was simple relational theory, and that still works today, and there's, you know, still that simplicity that we need to have. But the complexity is, if we're not dealing with the base Dublin core elements, who, what, when, where, why, we really miss the boat on the potential mashup that I think Mike was really getting to. And in particular, the interest that I have is in the where component. So the ability for us to have common spatial awareness between data sets allows that mashup capability to take place and for the future prediction of how the patterns might result. And if we're not doing that, we really miss our return on investment potential.
Yeah, I might add that I kind of like to think of it as almost a democratization of data that that's going to end up changing the nature of certainly the analytical cadre, both in the certainly in government communities as well as the commercial space, and that all of a sudden you're going to find as data becomes more available lower down in the organization that entirely new things can be discovered that weren't available to people at that level before.
So I think that term democratization is good for a number of reasons. When I think of big data, I think of a couple of things in terms of changing the dimensions. You know, currently we have data binned by different kinds of functional areas, command and control data, the location of our forces on the planet, geospatial data, the imagery that represents the physical layout of the world. As we start to aggregate what were viewed previously as dissimilar data types, we can potentially draw better and better conclusions about questions that we didn't previously ask about a particular data set. The other piece of big data that I think is important to note is the temporal aspect of it. Currently, in many situations, we limit specific filters the data sets we're looking at from a temporal point of view because we're interested in what's happening today, not what happened 2 weeks ago. And as we move towards this big data analytic future, we need to start expanding that filter in terms of keeping longer and longer time records of data so we can use it for other purposes.
Jeff, Mike, anything to add on that?
You know, I had a few things that made me think of. I think as these as you use big data and get better and better prediction, I think what comes out of this is this. If you can show somebody at the end of every week some really great prediction, pretty soon they say, well, why are you making me wait to the end of the week? I mean, I could have used it while it was happening. So I think we're going to continue to see a trend where organizations are trying to make sense of this big data closer to the time the transactions are happening. I will also tell you that I had one customer where because they had record data from 10 years ago in their big data, it allowed them to suss out the signal. Had they not seen this, had they not kept this 10-year-old record, they would not have found this particular connection in the data. And I'll just finally say that, you know, in my comments about another trend being that in big data, we're going to see more and more orthogonal data sets being pulled together. I concur completely. I'm seeing this happen, and it really improves the quality of prediction. And one of the new kinds of data sets that I think is going to start getting commingled with many other kinds is going to be is the where-when component. It's the geospatial lat-long in time and how things are moving. And when you take that kind of data and commingle with these others, it helps allow you to make more sense of all that other data.
So if I'm an organization, whether a government agency or a private enterprise, how do I have to think about investing in managing big data, and how is that different than my IT investment today? Or is it?
So I think that one of the primary concerns for you is going to be thinking globally instead of locally, not optimizing your IT investments for storing data locally for a particular purpose, but rather storing it globally for general purposes. And this is something we've all grown up in. We've had different lines of dollars, different appropriations that have been put in place for a specific purpose. And we need to start to move away from those specific line items and those specific IT investments to solve a one problem, but instead look towards aggregating those data sets up as well as aggregating the analytic capacity up so that it serves a more general purpose.
At the same time, I'd want to discourage any kind of forklift upgrades. You know, certainly in the analytical community, I kind of see a bifurcation in that in the one sense, we do what I would call entity-directed analytics very well. When we know the question to ask, especially if it's directed at a particular entity, we do a fairly good job of doing that analysis. On the other hand, there's a whole different type of analytics that I'd like to refer to as maybe lead generation or tip-off, and that's this making these correlations that no human being is going to make on their own. So I can see at the same time in this first set, I agree completely. We want to find ways to share the cloud, to share the data stores, to really start sharing information. But in the second set, we may need some highly specialized hardware, software applications to allow those particular instantiations to do their job extremely efficiently. But in large part, I agree.
There's one thing I'd add. I think that you touched on in terms of scale. So clearly, two things that we need to deal with on a faster and faster basis are time and space. Right? These are things that I think really beget big data sets. And to answer the investment question, we need to be really, really flexible in design. We tend to have the old school thought in design would often be, I'm designing for this scale in geography or this scale in time. And quite honestly, we need to really think about the design function to be at nano scale across all data sets. So it's inordinately precise spatially, inordinately precise temporally, or at least allow the flexibility for that to happen, because no matter what product we start looking at, the first thing I always hear is, oh, that's a great data set. Could it do this? And that next this is always at least the next scale up, either spatially or temporally.
Can I add something?
Go ahead.
I think it's absolutely essential as organizations go to start playing with big data, you can't first say, hey, you first have to re-engineer all of your existing operational systems. I mean, you'll just never get there if you have to go that route. And fortunately, you don't have to go that route. Another thing that resonated, a comment that was just made, is sometimes I'll see an organization discover a new problem they want to solve. And they go, well, let's build a whole new system just to study this one kind of data around that one problem. They just build a whole other system just for that. It's like, you know, just the magenta puzzle pieces. And I think it's these generalized systems where when you have a new problem or you have some new data that you want to look for stuff in that might be important, you want to take the magenta puzzle pieces to the rest of what the enterprise knows. So I think this new class of systems requires that you can have new data sources and new kinds of entities and new kinds of features. And you can contribute those to your big data models without having to land the plane, unload the database, change the database schema, and repopulate the database. And finally, you know, I think the future is not going to be waiting for humans to ask questions. I think if we count on that, we're going to be in big trouble, because there's not enough humans to think of every smart question to ask every day. So the future that I'm believing is going to happen, that's going to be more valuable than that, is this model that I refer to as the data finds the data and the relevance finds you. And that principle, just briefly, is when an enterprise gets a new piece of data anywhere in any of its systems, it just learns something. And it's at that split second you say, hey, now that I know that, how does it relate to what I know? That's like taking a puzzle piece to the puzzle. And after you figure out what you just observed relates to what you know, what you want to be able to do is say, hey, is that important? Should I tell somebody? And that's an example of relevance than finding a user. So I'm excited about that future and what that means for helping direct human attention.
If I can, I'd like to jump in and just make a few observations as well. I think it is absolutely right that these new analytical systems, the capacity to deal with new kinds of data, isn't going to replace the large investment that we've made in the federal sector, that we've made in the commercial sector, in existing systems. Look, we're running data management infrastructure today that's grown up for 30 years to solve hard problems, and those products are excellent. But we're confronted with the opportunity, really the requirement, to look at more kinds of data faster and in more detail using more sophisticated analytics than ever before. What's interesting to me, as a guy who spent my career in the relational database industry, is that for 20 years, the technology that got deployed in the data center was an RDBMS. Today, we see an explosion in the variety of systems that are being built. You hear terms like NoSQL. You see the emergence of column stores. You see Hadoop and MapReduce-style systems coming out of the web. All of a sudden, it's okay for a CIO, for a VP of systems, to buy something other than RDBMS and to assemble data management infrastructure with different capacity, with different properties to solve the specific problems that confront the org. It's important that all those pieces work together. You know, we've been talking about big data, and I think that that term is useful, but we're only calling it that now because it's new. It's just data, right? It used to be that it was hard to get your hands on a terabyte. Now, it's actually hard not to have a terabyte. You've got to be aggressive at throwing stuff away in order to keep data volume small. Even at just a few terabytes, new analytic capacity can make a big difference. You often want to ask machine learning or pattern detection questions of relatively small volumes. So we're really talking about building best-of-breed systems with a variety of capacities, with a variety of focuses aimed at analytical problems that are much broader than we ever solved before.
So just to follow up on what Jeff and Mike said, and at the risk of getting shot, I think we have to avoid the notion that there is some large data or big data and cloud computing nirvana out there. You know, when I talk to senior leaders about this particular area, they say, well, I want some of that cloud thingy. Get me that. And you have to then start with the discussion of what problems are you trying to solve. So providing that access to data, aggregating large amounts of data, critical. On the other hand, if we assume that we're going to have some generic processing architecture in the sky that can be used to solve any problem, perhaps that may be a misnomer. And we need to understand the kind of problems we're asking, the kind of analytics we want to run to understand the processing and some of the data access architectures are going to be critical to support those.
So I think that's a really great point that, in fact, we're actually very accustomed now to lots of data. We live with it. We work with it. We, you know, use it at home. And I think the other point that is being raised is what we need to get more comfortable with is, well, what can we actually find out? And there's a whole lot of issues associated with that. But I'd like to first focus on what is happening in the realm of what we can find out. Are there game-changing technologies? Are there new products and systems coming online that are making it easier for us to manage and deal with the amount of information and the amount of data that is available to us that we have to include into our new information technology architectures and into the way we work?
I'll take a crack at that to start. I think Jeff and several others have done a very good job of laying out sort of the notional massive data analytical system from a number of points. Entity disambiguation, or as he calls it, counting, is certainly probably a major, it is a linchpin in enabling some new things. However, down the road, I think it's very hard to even imagine what we're going to find. Certainly from an analytical standpoint, if you look at what is being enabled just by being able to count well, and we do have systems spinning up that are doing a very good job of that. This is enabling an analytical sense that to do with computers what people naturally can't do. For instance, lay out all the possible hypotheses and then not become emotionally charged with them and being able to back away from them. Right, so being able to sort of, with a computer, create the ideal analyst is certainly something I see coming, and way down the road, maybe even offering judgments and not just leads. And one other thing I'd like to just slip in there is it's pretty obvious that something big is happening because you're seeing the merging of a lot of empirical technologies, right? So we're talking about, you know, the data asking questions, then going off and investigating that. And we don't have really a theoretical underpinning for some of this. So it's going to be really hard to say what's going to be coming 10 years out. You know, in communication, there's a theory, Claude Shannon's theory, that says in a given channel, how much information can you pass through that channel capacity? Well, how much information is in a given fixed data set? And if you knew that theoretically, you'd know when, you know, the 80% point is, when you want to, you know, you're not going to get a lot more for more investment there. We have no idea right now. And it's not a static data set. There's data feeding into it. So we're just at the tip of the iceberg, and it's going to get really exciting in the coming years.
Okay. So I'd like to just follow on briefly. counting real, can I just jump in real quick and just add a little more meat to the bone on this, the counting that was just brought up? You know, if you bring a lot of data together and you're trying to make sense of it, a lot, some organizations are trying to then just take it straight to visualization or take it straight to a pattern detection engine looking for anomalies and outliers. And the reality is you can't really do amazing things there with big data unless you've properly counted your data. And what I mean by that is, as you've ingested all this data, is it five cases of H1N1 in five cities, or is it one case reported five times? Is it five people with each with one bank account, or is it one person with five bank accounts? If you don't handle that level of what I'll call expertly counting like things in the data, you cannot see the vector and the velocity. All your higher-level prediction systems, all your human direction attention, human attention directing systems are going to be riddled with false positives and false negatives if you don't first address this most underlying thing. And I think that has not been getting enough focus, so I've been talking about it a bit because it's so dang important.
Mike Olson?
So I absolutely agree with the stuff that Chris Nissen said just a little bit ago, and I want to pile on. It's true that we don't have a theory of data management that's as clean as Shannon or even Codd and Date laid out back in the late 70s, early 80s. I think what's happening right now is, if you're a Darwinist, kind of the Cambrian explosion. All kinds of new techniques, all kinds of new technologies are being built out to deal with data. Much of the underlying theory is ad hoc. So we have now these distributed in-memory hash tables for delivering stuff in real time very, very quickly. What kind of analytics can we build on that? Now we're figuring that out still. Right? You've got these large-scale distributed batch processing systems out of the web world, Hadoop, for example. What kind of problems do they solve? Interesting ones. What's the theory underlying that? I'd argue it's too early for us to know that. We need right now to allow this variety, this evolutionary wealth to happen. We'll choose technologies that are really compelling, that are really valuable. What's exciting to me is those technologies now are available. It does mean, if you're thinking about building out data management infrastructure, if you want to answer questions, you got to be a little bit smarter than you used to, because there's not just one thing to choose from. There's about 30, and you got to go find the five that are going to make a difference for you.
So since we've rattled off a number of names and acronyms of game-changing technologies, I'm going to avoid that. I think the real game-changers here aren't technologies. They're new philosophy, cultural, and policy changes that are taking place. We're starting to see senior leadership in the Department of Defense and the intelligence community understand the benefit of aggregation of large amounts of data, understand the benefit of removing what are, you know, essentially organizational boundaries that disincentivize data sharing, and move towards aggregating these data sources. And to get back to something we heard earlier, democratize, open it up so that analytics can be performed by multiple organizations, by multiple different users in a hierarchy, and then providing very simple, easy-to-use interfaces, RESTful interfaces, web services interfaces, and then building on top of those straightforward technologies such as widgets, and giving end users the ability to mash up data types to answer questions.
A couple last points on this one. I think everyone's touched on it pretty well. The things that I would add are the real estate question for how we consume data is, I think, inordinately important. So we're seeing over the last couple of years an explosion in dashboard technologies, and those are definitely novel. Let's assume, you know, we nail Jeff's question right, that we account well. Totally important. Very much agree with him, but. We're seeing, I think, new things going on in dashboarding and visualization that allows multi-dimensional variables to be displayed in a very tight space. And let's be honest, the space everyone wants is 3x5. It's got to be on my iPhone. And if it's not, we miss that. So we have to think very carefully about the consumption point. And if the consumption point isn't 3x5, I think we miss a big market. The second point is it's highly me-centric. And we miss the boat a lot on this. We think about these gross analytics, these high degree of aggregations, but one of the things that's really driving the demand for big data a lot is me. where am I today? What is it that I want to buy right now? Who is it that I want to interact with right now? The whole notion of getting data to me, where I am, when I am, is actually pretty important and evolves around lots and lots of end data points, which feeds on Dave's last point, the notion of simple. We have to be publishing these as open, restful services. And at FCC, we're beginning to take that step. We just released fcc.gov/developer, which is suites of restful services for lots of our endpoints. So it's definitely a tip of the iceberg, but I think we'll see a lot more of it.
So this is an interesting perfect storm. You know, we've got technology. We've got data that's everywhere. We've got the need to deal with ourself in this equation, and we've got the whole cultural leadership dimension to this issue. And, you know, that hasn't happened in a while, maybe since, like, the birth of the Internet. So it's interesting to see and be in of this time. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about kind of the disruptive nature of this phenomena and how it we really need to pay attention to the cultural aspects of it, not only how we as leaders need to change to think about how to use the information, but how we actually help others get over their fears. You know, are there, you know, serious issues about this topic that we need to be aware of? And as we not only think about technology standards or other kinds of standards, are there cultural standards we need to be paying attention to?
So once again, at the risk of getting myself shot, we have a huge cultural issue in the Department of Defense in that we're very hierarchical, and the way we do business today is data is developed at very low levels, and analytics are performed and reports are generated, and they're reviewed and chopped and sent up a chain. And weeks later, the senior leader has situational awareness and what happened, and he can have absolutely no control over. So our most senior leaders in the Department of Defense want to change that. They want to crush that hierarchy and have access to that information in near real time and have access to the value added of analytics as they're developed, not after the fact, after it's reviewed. And this is a very difficult thing for many in the Department of Defense to come to grips with, because what that means is your boss three levels above you is going to know what you know when you know it. And it's counter to the culture that we've grown up in.
Situational awareness is a week old. It's not actually not situational awareness. It's like historical reflection.
But that's what we got.
I'd highlight what I think is an upcoming policy and really social challenge. I think that access to data at this scale, understanding what's going on in the world in ways we never did before, is going to change our lives, not just what's happening in government or in the defense space or in commerce, but our lives in ways we don't foresee today. Just as the transistor, just as the PC, just as mobile phones change society fundamentally, data is going to change society fundamentally in ways we can't foresee. The biggest issue I see looming is, what is privacy, what does security mean when data is everywhere? When information about your location and your activity spreads out on the web and among organizations, I think it's going to be increasingly difficult for us to constrain access to data. I think it's going to be everywhere, and we have to change from thinking about scarcity to restricting the ability to see data. We have to think about social and policy ways to control what people are allowed to do with data. What decisions can an insurance company make once my DNA sequence is available to them? Because that will happen, right? I see no real way to constrain access to data in the long term. I think what we have to do is think about what people are allowed to do with that data and how we manage that risk.
I couldn't agree more. Right. And attribution and retribution are going to end up being two pivotal things that come up both in the legal system and in the technical system, right? So when you get down to that point and you just advance your, you know, let your imagination wander 3 to 5 years out, if we don't have a means of going back and saying what is the confidence in the judgment that we're making or in the decision that we're making, but as the lawsuits and everything else come together, how did you get there? And I would argue that for a lot of the systems being put together right now, we might not have any idea. So attribution and retribution as design elements way down in the system are really going to end up being pivotal. The other piece of this is going to be the countermeasures. So far, there probably isn't a lot of that going on. But I can almost guarantee that you're going to start to see not so much anonymization, but people trying, organizations and entities trying to deliberately publish false information in a range of different ways, right? Not just something, you know, pretty basic and rudimentary today. So the whole ECCM game is going to be played out, and I would argue so far we haven't seen really anything sophisticated in terms of countermeasure, but you're going to see that in both the public and private sectors.
So now we're going to have to focus on countermeasures where we release false information about our analytics and capabilities so that our adversaries will try to deceive us in a way different than our analytics really work.
So I think the point earlier about we don't know how it's going to change is actually pretty important, right? We do know that it's increasing in scale exponentially. Time and space. And that definitely brings up interesting challenges. We're going to have to deal with those challenges a lot more, a lot faster. In the public policy world, though, I definitely think the good overshadows that. The speed with which people want access to data is always going to increase, and the deliberative process of the regulatory environment and the lawmaking environment is actually deliberately slow. That has a very unique challenge, and I think that challenge outweighs a lot of the privacy concerns that are in the massive debate now. We're going to have that democratization happen in a policy space in the regulatory environment meeting room as the decision comes up. We're going to have the democratization of that data available for an instant mashup while Congress is meeting, while they're debating that issue. That to me is a far more interesting question, and I think that where it gets outweighed.
So, what I'd like us to do now, I mean, we've been talking about what big data is, how you have to think about managing it, and not actually reinventing everything that you own, and some of the risks, challenges, and fears associated with it. How can we start to tell our listeners? What they might expect, even just today, you know, what are some of the very interesting things that we can actually do today based on the technology we have, the data we have, and the kinds of analytics that we have available to us right now?
Inordinate amounts of real-time visualization. I mean, the one that we like to consume all the time is, of course, the weather or the traffic, right? But even 3-4 years ago, you didn't see the red line on Google Map that said, you know, the beltway is backed up, right? You didn't see that. We now have 311 or 511 systems that allow that real time. We're going to see that more and more. So I'm going to hammer on the geospatial, temporal, multidimensional, real time aspect because we've got, you know, 150 million cell phone users out there that are constantly acting as sensors, sending in data. That's a very novel thing.
And that, in particular, cell phones sending in data, GPS units, measuring time and distance traveled means we'll have, you know, a much better picture of what our infrastructure looks like, what our patterns of use look like, and how we can optimize our investments in real-world infrastructure versus cyber infrastructure. But we're going to have to always circle back on that issue of privacy and how we ensure that, larger need of being able to use that data to, fix 495 doesn't conflict with someone's personal need to not necessarily be known their whereabouts every time of the day.
Yeah, so I think as a systems engineer, and I think of ingesting and classifying data as it's coming in, extracting information from that data, and then doing disambiguation on entities or counting that data. There's been an awful lot of research. So what are we doing well now? We're doing the second stage really, really well, right? From natural language processing to text extraction, you know, there's just been a ton of money poured in that from the commercial world and the government sectors. And that's going to get really interesting because as we start to build systems that are multi-streamed, can we afford to start doing some of those less accurately and in exchange for pulling in other data from different streams. So we're doing that well. And the disambiguation piece, I think the last 3 years or so have really been tremendous in that you look back 5 years and we were doing a pretty poor job of that. And that is really, really the enabler here. So getting that done right and getting it done in a way that we don't have to keep rebuilding the databases, you know, once a week or something is going to be the next minor challenge. And then the big one is going to be moving on to the analytical space.
So Mike, you're placing some bets here. What do you see as some of the real big needs that are going to drive people to the good side of this?
Well, we can look at what's been happening in Washington. What have been the big policy debates lately? Financial services, what's happening in the markets? That's a big, big deal. These tools are already being used right now to better assess risk, to better understand my position in the market as an individual and the aggregate position of whole firms and whole sectors. I think that being smarter about risk is critical. And both the government and the large banks and others making investments are going to roll these tools out to better manage their positions, to make better decisions. You know, if you look at what's happening in healthcare reform, that debate fundamentally is going to be shaped by technology, delivering services better, more intelligently, using information well. Again, these systems allow that to happen. It's early days yet, and we're going to see an explosion in the deployment of those systems in those markets. I think in general that IT will be central to commerce and policy over the course of the next 10 years. These tools allow us to get a much better picture of the world in much more depth than we've ever had before.
You know, we've been talking a lot about how big data and new analytic models are going to better empower people, but I think it's important to point out that what's also going to happen is this big data and these new analytic models are going to not always just direct humans. Some of this data is going to be, some of the predictions that can be made are going to not be sent to humans, and they're going to be sent right back to other systems or right back to the sensor itself. I mean, it might be big data that while the UAV is flying and taking pictures, big data and these analytic models tell the UAV to get the hell out of Dodge. There's no human in the loop. So I think that's going to be part of what we see with big data.
I couldn't agree more. That's a point I wanted to bring up down the road, that we tend to think in terms of, you know, either a business analyst or a government analyst consuming. But I think some of the real earth-shattering moves are going to come, for instance, in the cybersecurity area. Networks today are becoming so complex, and there's just a tremendous amount of in-band and out-of-band data flowing through them, that the control planes are still being managed using technologies from 10 or 15 years ago or longer. So this whole area is going to enable a machine-driven control system, not just in networks, but in UAVs, as was just pointed out, and a whole range of applications.
So if I listen to the dialogue, one of the things that is on my mind as a professional is the people. How do I think about training the next generation, my current generation? What should I be doing as someone who cares about people, someone who's interested in job creation and being competitive in the marketplace? What's your all advice about, you know, what we need to do individually and collectively in terms of learning?
So step one would be to start with that philosophy in, you know, my area, the Department of Defense. It's to try to drive home at every opportunity we're moving from a need-to-know society to a need-to-share society. And the other thing that's important that we try to ensure that we hammer every time we can is that information does not have a chain of command. Decisions do. Information does not.
So the great thing about being a geographer is that there's nothing that isn't interesting, and we only have one law. And that law is the closer things are, the more related they are. So to build on Dave's point, the everything is more and more interrelated. It's just that we're starting to see those patterns emerge. So those new resources encourage them to do other things than write code. They have to read the op-eds. They have to know what's on above the fold. They have to know how the issue today is related to that issue that I haven't thought of that someone else is thinking about so that we can share that data.
It is really the story about discoverability. It's like, who has what piece of data that's related to what it is that you're looking for? And, you know, I think about it like a library. If somebody puts a book on the shelf at the library, but they don't give a library card to the librarian, who's going to ever find it? So when I hear people talk about information sharing, I think about things like ICD, Intelligence Community Directive number 501, which is all about discoverability. And when we solve discoverability, it's going to be solved by creating indexes like card catalogs. Instead of subject, title, author, it's going to be who, what, where, when. And we're going to find that you're going to have to do this in large and a few indexes, not federated search. And when you do that, by the way, it becomes big data. There's a lot of interesting phenomena about these indexes, but that's how information sharing is really going to be solved, because you can figure out instantly, you know, which of the Library of Congress buildings and which floor and which shelf and what, Dewey Decimal Number to ask somebody about.
I said, you know, there's been a lot of talk over the last 10 years, 20 years about the information economy. I would say we're only just now getting there. You could say that right now we're in the ignorance economy. We've got an opportunity to know a lot of stuff driven by new data, new information we're collecting. But we don't yet know how to analyze that stuff well. It's still far too much of an art form in order to do that analysis. I think we need people with a new mix of an understanding of what's interesting, the kind of I read the op-eds, I know what questions I want answered, with technical skills, analytic skills, the ability to bring some mathematics and statistics to bear here that are really going to enable us as a society to take advantage of this information. I don't think we know how to train those people yet, and I don't think we really understand that job description well enough yet. And I think that's critical. If we could invest in educating people to exploit this data, if we could make guys smart about how to build the computer programs that answer questions, we would go a long way toward assuring our competitiveness in the global market and really using these systems for social and policy good.
So should I tell my kids to triple major in computer science, math, and political science, maybe?
History, yeah. Yeah,
if you were watching The Graduate today, the one word would be data.
Very well said, and it doesn't go unnoticed. I mean, you know, we're all thinking about the same thing. My daughter's a freshman in college right now, and you know, we're asking the same question: where is the future? What, and the social media effects on how they learn and what they want to learn is actually impacting them to have the kind of diversity of education that you guys have talked about today.
Yeah, no, my daughter's studying marketing, and I'm trying to get her to think about socionomics, right? And I think, and I look at the way that they teach marketing in college today, and it's going to be different in just a few years from now.
So let me take a minute here to thank our panelists. We've had a really good conversation about big data. We've tried to, you know, define it a bit, talk about how it should be managed in the context of what you have today and how you should introduce new ways of thinking about that. And then finally, you know, how do you use it and how do you make use of it in such a way is that you can take advantage of it and not be afraid of it. So thanks to the panelists. Today's presentation and Expert Voices has been Big Data, Advancing the Art of Analytics. This is Chris Kelly with Booz Allen Hamilton. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Booz Allen Hamilton's panel discussion on Big Data, the Art of Advanced Analytics on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. To hear this show in its entirety and more information, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Booz Allen.
The application of knowledge discovery within the cloud is immensely powerful, but not inbuilt. As organizations continue to better understand the analytic power and economies of cloud computing in the sense of data storage, sharing, and management, they are discovering that big data is more than just a discussion of technology. It's a discussion of what can be accomplished when massive data and cloud efficiencies combine to make advanced analysis and innovation possible. Booz Allen Hamilton has developed an integrated approach to cloud computing, systems development, trust, cybersecurity, and advanced analytics and innovation, and we help government at all levels build effective online applications that protect critical assets and improve the speed and effectiveness of constituent services to deliver time and cost savings. Booz Allen is ready for what's next. Learn more at boozallen.com/expertvoices.
In Depth with Francis Rose, Monday through Friday, 1 to 3 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Want to know how Congress is affecting your agency, staffing, and budget? Want to learn more about the relationship between your agency and its contractors? In Depth helps you become a better manager by exploring the best ways to manage projects, manage your workforce, and manage yourself. In Depth with Francis Rose, weekday afternoons from 1 to 3 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.